And it is our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign, our 20th. And this is also the first time that we have gone 2 weeks on one topic, but it's a pretty broad topic and one that's really been forefront a lot lately. And we're dealing with prejudice, privilege, and the violence of otherism. We've got a wonderful panel today, so I think it's about time we introduced everyone, starting with my partner for the past 20 years, Sherry Johnson.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Sherry Johnson. I'm Director of Field Education in the Department of Social Work at Humboldt State University and a board member of the Humboldt County Domestic Violence Coordinating Council. And to my left,
Gary Eagles, Humboldt County Superintendent of Schools, and I'm privileged to be back again. I was actually part of this project probably about 10 years.
Yes. Okay, Gary, remember that? That's right.
Yeah, it's good to be back.
And I'm Greg Gold. I'm a professor of psychology at Humboldt State University. I've been teaching psychology of prejudice there since 2000.
And I'm Christy Johnson. I'm currently working at the Redwood Coast Regional Center as a service coordinator in the children's unit.
And you were with the Educational Opportunities Program at Humboldt State University?
Yes, I was.
Yeah.
Fantastic. All right, so it is a broad topic, and it's always kind of hard to figure out where to start.
Right. It's big. And I think the recent news has given us all a permission to have these kind of conversations, and I don't think we can have enough of these conversations. And this has been it's been wonderful to hear from these different lens, the different vantage points, all of the people, all of the interviews, and really encourage people who haven't been able to listen live that you can go to the KHUM website and click on the really pretty little logo there, Stop the Violence, in the corner, and you can hear the past shows. And it has been amazing to have these interviews and the panel last Friday to have people talk about what being otherized means, and it's got so many different levels and so many different ways of approach, and so we want to just like keep it free for all of us to express our feelings about this, and maybe we want to talk a little bit about what we think each of us, what we think bias and otherizing means. And Christy, I'm going to start with you.
Of course you are. So, wow, that's a huge question. So, bias, I mean, I don't know how many different ways can you define that. So, basically, I mean, it's huge. Sorry, I don't know how to.
That's all right.
Can I get a... So anyways, bias is any kind of, I want to say discriminatory thought or feeling. I mean, more like, because we don't know it's bias until people act on it.
Right.
Because
right.
If they keep it inside as thoughts, I mean, it is what it is inside the headspace. But once it turns into action, whether it's words or a direct act towards somebody because of how they identify, then I feel like that's a bias. Whether it's the way you assume they identify or someone has outright identified in a way that makes you act negatively towards them, that to me is bias. And you asked another question right before that.
And otherization, what is
otherization?
It?
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
What does it mean to be
that? I mean, that's a lot easier for me. Otherisms or otherizing, it makes it easy for people to go, oh, it's not me, it's them.
Right.
You know, it's those people that are causing those issues. Or I've heard a lot, not you, Christy, those other people that identify as you identify because you're different because I know you, you know.
Right.
So to put the burden off on someone else. And not have to actually pay attention or get details or even the truth.
Right, right. Thanks. Dr. Gold.
Well, it's always dangerous to ask a professor a question
especially when you actually teach.
Yeah,
we get paid to talk.
Of prejudice.
We get paid to talk for hours, even if nobody answers. So
I like having people on who talk. Right. I like talkers.
So bias is a good one, I think it is. You can think of it in three ways. So you can think of bias as stereotypes. You can think of bias as prejudice, and you can think of bias as discrimination. And the key thing underlying all of those, and I'll talk a little bit more about them in a second, is that with stereotypes, those are thoughts or quote unquote what people think are facts, overgeneralizations about a group that are unwarranted. Mm-hmm. So they're simply not true, and then people apply them to individuals. And so if you say, well, you know, all Irish people are drunks, that's a stereotype. It's simply not true. Where the difficulty lies is if you say, well, most Mexicans speak Spanish, that's not a stereotype, mm-hmm. and that is true. And where the battles in society take place in the media and in terms of trying to convince people of things is you know what's true and what isn't true in terms of what you can say about a person and about a group. So that's the stereotypes. And the prejudice, of course, is the feelings that are unwarranted. And prejudice can be negative or positive. We often think of it as negative prejudice, but positive prejudice exists too, where it's a feeling about a person, typically based on their group membership, that is also not warranted. It is simply not true, and it's often tied to the stereotypes that people hold about groups and the groups to which a person belongs.
It's interesting. I've never actually heard positive prejudice before.
Well, I think Asian is the special minority,
right.
Because we're so smart.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Or... I'm Jewish, for example, so some people might think I would make a good accountant, right?
Lawyer, I would make doctor?
as my mother repeatedly says to every single person that she meets, yes.
My son's a doctor? Well, you have a PhD, so right. She can't say that.
Yeah, it counts.
It
yeah.
counts, yeah. It counts. Well, it depends on who you're talking to. So, so that would be a positive prejudice. And that also puts people at a disadvantage when somebody will hire somebody from a certain group based on, like men make better leaders, for example, right? That's sort of something that people carry around in their head, mm-hmm. Which makes it often hard, particularly in this country, for women to get elected. But that's a positive prejudice people have about men. So
and a bias.
And a bias, mm-hmm. Yeah. It's all part of bias. Mm-hmm. And then when people actually, as Christy was saying, when people actually act on their prejudice, positive or negative feelings, which is typically based on their stereotypes, because mm-hmm. nobody wants to think that they're unjustified in what they're doing, that often results in discrimination, which is the treatment of a person that is unwarranted, not deserved, by the individual person based on typically the group to which they belong. So when I think of bias, I often think about it in those three components, and it helps me break it down when I think of what society is doing and how society is treating folks. So when people get upset about the PC world, how come we can't make jokes about people? And, you know, why it's so PC, we can't say these negative mm-hmm. things. Well, actually... You shouldn't
it's hurtful.
Be. It's hurtful.
That's why.
Right. It's hurtful.
To be conscious of how people feel is not, it shouldn't be chastised.
Correct.
It should be supported.
Correct. Yeah. And then it reinforces the stereotypes.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Thank you so much. That was very helpful. Because we've been kind of swimming around with mm-hmm. these terms, that helps put a little order to our swirling there. Dr. Eagles, your turn.
Well, I'd like to add to the conversation a little different twist from how I see an interplay with this, and it has to do with two elements. One is choice, the other is accountability. We all make choices about our behaviors. We make choices about our attitudes, and that governs our daily activities. Now, where this conversation is so meaningful is that it helps if people listen and then do reflection about how they behave. What are their attitudes? And how are we influenced by other people's attitudes and situations as well? The issue was raised earlier about, well, you know, once you get to know somebody better, you see them in a different lens. But what are our choices? Who do we associate with? Are we limiting our own growth by those attitudes, beliefs, prejudices, bias that we learn to develop over time? Because we're not born with those. Those are our acquired perceptions. And how are we harming ourselves by some of those things, in addition to the harm that we have for others? It's a question of choice. Then it gets back to the accountability. In my mind, it is not only a societal accountability, it's an individual accountability in the sense that we all have the opportunity to influence others. It's not a question of whether or not we do influence, it's a question of how we go about influencing. And we can all make a difference. And that's what I tell faculty members. I said, you're all teachers and you can all teach. But it's what you teach and what you mentor and the examples that you set that are important. Mm-hmm. So there has to be meaningful reflection on exactly what is it that we want to reflect individually and as we go through our daily life. And look at it from the standpoint of two things, as I said earlier, not only the harm we may be doing to others, by our attitudes, beliefs, perceptions that may or may not be accurate. But what is the harm we're doing to ourselves by not opening up and be more willing and accepting of a broader range of individuals and situations?
Oh, beautiful, beautiful. It occurs to me that before we can have that ability to reflect like that, we have to really look at the cultural context in which we grew. And so how, Christy, I'll go back to you. And Cliffy, you're going to jump in here, just interrupt any time, you know. But how relevant and powerful is the family and the family's beliefs and values in growing up? How powerful is that in all of this?
Well, I mean, it's vastly important. I don't even know where to start. Again, it's so important. I mean, I'm not gonna maybe you can throw some theory in there later. I learned plenty.
Well, I can throw lots of things.
Plenty in the psych and the social work department. But I mean, when you talk about, I also used to work for the Department of Health and Human Services as a child welfare social worker. And I mean, when you meet with a family, the first thing you do is you draw an ecogram. You know, you put the person in the middle, and then you have all these things coming off of this middle circle or whatever thing you wanted to draw around the child's name. And then you talk about the influence of people and things and activities and how it's led to that child being either coming into our system of care or bringing the family to the attention of the department. And even going back further into my childhood, I don't even think I would be here if it wasn't for the many influences that I've had coming, you know, stemming off of me. When you think of it in terms of genograms, when I think of things, I think of them in shapes. And so, you know, mm-hmm. Ecograms are like one of the best tools you can think of. And then you have circles coming off those circles. So when you have someone who's influencing you, you know, what's influenced that person? You know, mm-hmm. when we approach somebody and you know, they have these biases and ideas and discrimination, so have what, you know, let me step back. What has that person gone through? Mm-hmm. You know, what has influenced that person to think what they have? Was there a singular incident that happened and now they're overgeneralizing it to a certain group of people? You know, when we talk to people and they have, you know, whatever, you know, kind of bias they have with them, it's always important to kind of address it And from an educational standpoint, you know, some people kind of get super angry about it and they just start like yelling at people. That's kind of one of my first learning experiences away from the home in college was someone like yelling at me, "Don't say that. That's the worst thing ever that you could ever say in life." And I'm just like, "I don't even know what I said. What are you why are you yelling at me? Who are you?" You know, and that became one of the things you did when you're into social justice, you just start yelling at people who say wrong things and do wrong things. And, you know, without educating on why you shouldn't, mm-hmm. it doesn't mean anything. It just kind of, as a matter of fact, I just shut down. You know, I was like, first of all, you're not my parent. You know, you don't tell me what's right and wrong. And I'm a pretty stable person walking around here on this college campus with you, too. So, you know, then the fight or flight kicks in, right? And you just either shut down or you listen. But without that educational part, you're not going to ever get a chance to have that. And so when we talk about educating people, then again, you're talking about, you know, what what capacity does that person have? And again, that comes from their influences. You know, have things always been beaten into them, or have things, you know, been presented to the person so that they can pick and choose and do the research that they need to do to learn? So, I mean, I can go off on this forever. Like, you picked the wrong person to start, maybe. But I mean, the influence, it just, I don't even, I mean, yeah, let me stop before I go further, but yeah.
There was a lot in there, a lot of food in there,
right,
for thought.
And what I need to do is take a break. There is lots of things that that have come up in the news just this past week. Like, for instance, what's going on at the University of Missouri. That was glaring in the news all week long, and we definitely need to touch on that. And, of course, the presidential debates that have been going on, there's just a lot of otherism going on in those as well. So there's a lot of stuff for us to talk on, but I think what we need to do is let our sponsors say a few words. So we'll take a quick break, and we'll be back with this discussion in just a moment. And a reminder that this is open to you. This is not just us folks in here talking. This is a community discussion, and we'd love you to join in and ask a question, make a comment. 786-KHUM. That's 786-5486. If you get a ring, just let it continue ringing until I get a chance to answer it, because we don't have a panel of operators standing by. It's just me. Also, you can send in a question or a comment to studio@khum.com. All right, we continue our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign, and this is our big open panel discussion here. And we were just talking about, I guess, family influences, correct?
Right, and, right. How powerful is that? And it's Dr. Gold's turn.
I imagine it's hugely powerful.
Well, okay, we're on the radio, so I've got to be careful, but if I may, I'm going to use the F word, Freud.
Oh my gosh, that's so funny.
That was great.
Yeah.
Everyone took a deep breath.
Yeah, right. I know.
The button was just about to be pressed. The pause.
Everyone's eyes get wide.
You know, it's interesting when you think about the family and the kind of influences it has. Of course, you know, you can think of in terms of broad influences like religion or values or attitudes towards various things. But I think one thing that often gets overlooked sometimes is that when we're very young, we learn about relationships and we learn about trust in people from how our caregivers treat us, starting at a very young age. Can we trust them? Do they treat us well? If we need something, do they respond quickly, or do they ignore it? Does the world seem like it's a safe place or not a safe place? And I think those early influences do carry on much later on in life, and they affect how people then react in terms of the discussion we're having today, in terms of stopping the violence or other isms. So, for example, if you're raised in an environment where care is inconsistent, you can't really know if your parents love you or they don't love you, and you don't get that secure feeling. Well, naturally, you're going to then approach the world as a unpredictable, insecure, more threatening place. And if you view the world in a more threatening place, then well, then naturally you're going to be afraid of people that you don't understand or maybe have different values than you do. And so it could affect your thinking in terms of a broad approach to how you might approach people from different groups and different values, or even people who look different or maybe speak with an accent or a different language.
Right. So. Right. Dr.
Evans. Oh, my turn.
Your turn.
You know, yes, the influences of family are great, but we don't have to actually follow those influences. We can take different courses. My situation was a little unique, and if the audience doesn't mind listening to me a little bit, talk about that and how I coped with it.
Please.
First of all, as everybody who knows me personally knows that I'm physically handicapped. I was afflicted with polio and paralyzed from the waist down when I was under two. My mother at the time was paralyzed from the neck down and actually never did regain her strength and was wheelchair bound until she passed away. That was a traumatic situation for our family, and one of the great gifts of, however, of that tragedy was my mother's mother, who was divorced and living in Reno, came down to take care of her family, as she looked at it, and thought she'd be there just for a short while. As it turned out, she was there. She lived with with us until she actually passed away many years later. It was interesting growing up. I was an only child. It was an interesting growing up with two mothers is what I ended up having in the household. So as a handicapped person, I learned to deal with people that couldn't accept handicaps, mm-hmm. made judgments about my abilities or not as to whether or not I could do something or should do something. And I was made fun of by people who didn't understand. But then I had two very caring mothers who doted on me and wanted to nurture me and support, as the professor was talking about, in terms of made me feel safe and caring. But in that context, I learned how to do something for one of them that I didn't do for the other, because there were interestingly some inherent jealousies that actually played out between the two of them in terms of raising me. The other influence in my family, of course, was my father. My father didn't even complete eighth grade, was himself a hardworking, loyal, dedicated individual, and a good father in so many respects. But because of his experiences in life, he was extremely prejudiced against certain racial groups and other groups of folks, as it were. And it made for interesting conversations at the dining table. And over the years, I learned to basically tune that out, mm-hmm. because I couldn't accept his bias. And I looked at it from the standpoint as I just didn't think he knew. So I had these two wonderful women in my life, my mother and my grandmother, who taught me to be very sensitive to where other people are coming from. I was afflicted with a handicap that taught me resiliency, actually, in standing up to others who didn't treat me the way I would like to have been treated. And then I had my dad, who was an example of, in some ways, so many things of what to do, but in this regard, so many things of what not to do. I grew up in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area. I guess I should define that, because we're in a humble Bay Area, mm-hmm. right? I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area along with a great many individual cultures and races and economic situations, which I felt was a very good situation. And I remember that I was not even cognizant of a lot of differences in life until I actually, my family moved to Roseville, north of Sacramento. This is obviously eons ago. and in all Caucasian area. And it wasn't until I actually had a young friend of mine, as we were walking down the hallway one day, I think I was probably a sophomore in high school. And my friend, jabs me in the side and says, "Look at that." And I look. And I'm thinking to myself, what did he see? A very attractive girl? What? I mean, that's where my head went as a sophomore in high school. And no, he was actually pointing out a young student who a new enrollee of color. Mm-hmm. And frankly, it wasn't even till then that I ever noticed color. Because color and backgrounds and cultures were all part of what I had grown up with.
Sure.
This was an individual, my friend, who had not grown up there. He was a native of the Roseville area. And for him, that was different. And he called it out to my attention. But for me, I, up until that time, I think I could actually have said I was colorblind. And I prefer to look at life that way today.
Interesting. Now, one of the things that you brought up was your handicap, that occurred from polio. And this is something, there has been bias about that for quite some time. As a matter of fact, of course, we all know Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was president for four terms, hid that very successfully for a long time because there was such a bias against those with handicaps. There are people who actually thought it diminished one's mental capacities.
Mm-hmm. Yes, quite so.
Yeah. So
people who look at individuals who have physical disabilities can tend to generalize that and sure. believe they are less of an individual because
overall.
Of that. Yes, mm-hmm. actually. And of course, working in education, and we deal a lot of work with special education. I always encourage my faculty and staff to look for the strengths, not concentrate on the weaknesses that individuals may have, because we build on those strengths and we can elevate, and not to be surprised when somebody does something that is unexpected because we have those higher expectations.
Right. And again, a lot of these things are learned. When I was I was born in 1957, so there was still children my age who were thalidomide babies, and I went to school with a girl who was a thalidomide victim, if you will. She had flippers for arms, and I did not notice that as anything strange. She was just someone that I went to school with, I was actually quite attracted to her, to be honest, and until some other people pointed out that she was weird, and I was like, why? What's weird? I mean, that was just who she was. It was just another person that, at that age, it wasn't an unusual thing. But it was, once it was pointed out, I was like, this is so odd. This is such a strange thing that people are making judgments just because, she had, because she had what's these little plastic things on her hands to help her hold things. She mm-hmm. called her helper, And I always thought it was cool. I wish I had a helper. It was like, that's so cool. I want one of those,
Well, Cliff, your experience was very much like that friend of mine who was pointing out an individual of color, and I hadn't thought about that. I hadn't looked through those lenses. And that's what we have to do, is we have to figure out how do we see the world? Because how we see the world and make judgments about the world influences those behaviors. And we can think differently. We can process differently. We can adjust our attitudes accordingly. And we can also influence others to think and act differently as well.
Yeah. So I'm going to take a quick break. We touched on a few things that we never actually got to. And that, of course, is University of Missouri, the Tim Wolf situation there. And, of course, the political debates where otherism seems to be at the forefront, gaining through otherism, which is kind of an unfortunate thing that seems to be going on. Anyway, our sponsors have a few words they need to say. We will let them. It is 8:38, and you've got it on KHUM. We have our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign. We are dealing with privilege, prejudice, and the violence of otherism. Got a wonderful panel discussion going on right now, and it is certainly open for your input as well. 786-KHUM, that's 786-5486. If you get a ring, just let it continue ringing until I get a chance to pick up the phone. You can also email studio@khum.com. Probably we should probably once again go around the room, introduce ourselves. We'll start with my partner over the past 20 years, Sherry Johnson.
I'm Sherry Johnson. I'm Director of Field Education in the Department of Social Work at Humboldt State University and a board member of the Humboldt County Domestic Violence Coordinating Council.
Gary Eagles, Humboldt County Superintendent of Schools.
Greg Gold, Professor of Psychology at Humboldt State University.
And
I've been teaching Psychology of Prejudice since 2000.
Yes. 2000.
Wow.
That's a long time.
2000. 2000.
Good voice.
And I'm Christy Johnson. I'm currently with Redwood Coast Regional Center as a service coordinator in the Children's Unit and formerly of Humboldt State University in the Educational Opportunity Program.
And a graduate
of the Master's in Social Work Program and the Psych Department undergrad.
Yay!
There we go.
Yeah. I hit all the little...
That's our plug.
Okay, fantastic. So, the thing that's been in the news a lot this week, you know, has been University of Missouri and how they dealt with racism in the eventual...
Or didn't. But now have.
And the eventual ouster of the president, Tim Wolf. Mm-hmm. And it's been a very interesting thing. There's still a lot of turmoil going on there on that campus. And I think it's kind of an eye-opening thing of, you know, people deal or don't deal with racism. Because it is out there. And I guess I want to ask you, Greg, you deal, this is your topic, this is what you teach. You teach the psychology of prejudice. I'd like you to weigh in on, you know, what's going on there.
Okay, I will. So, it's actually fascinating to me on a number of different levels what's been going on at the university, not only in terms of the fact that apparently, of course, I'm saying apparently because all I know is what I read in the news. Apparently, there has been a long history of racist incidents that the university has not responded to in an appropriate manner, and so that's one fascinating aspect. And the other fascinating aspect is that this really came to national attention when the football team...
Right. That's such an interesting thing.
Mm-hmm. It's so fascinating because, you know, football is such a huge part of the culture here in the U.S.
Absolutely.
And particularly, in the South and the Midwest. It's enormous. And so when the football team... finally said, look, we're not going to play anymore.
Until you deal with this.
Until the president and the chancellor resign. It was a specific demand.
And they said, okay.
That was wielding a lot of power.
It was wielding a lot of power, yeah. So we could probably have an entire show about football the psychology of sports and sports on college campuses and that kind of thing. But here's the really interesting thing is that, and this gets back to the otherism. Okay. History of racist incidents, a history of the university not dealing with it. So why not? You know, why wasn't the university
dealing with it?
Why didn't the university take it seriously? Why didn't the university at least make an effort to the students and the faculty and the staff there to give the impression that they were doing everything they could to stop it? And I think that really gets back to the original question of what is otherism? It's because it was happening to people that were not part
of the ruling class that were not part of the majority in that state mm-hmm. or in that country or in that university, mm-hmm. right, and in this country. And when those kinds of things happen, oftentimes it goes unnoticed because it's not happening to, quote unquote, my group.
Right.
It's happening to
the other.
Them.
The other.
Yeah.
And people don't care as much about what happens to the other. And we
and even if they do, it's kind of like, well, that's a shame.
Well, and we've been talking about privilege as well. And so mm-hmm. that's the privilege, is that you don't have to care.
That's part of privilege, and it's also part of power.
Right.
There's some really fascinating, for me, psychological studies. I always have to preface that, because not everything I think is fascinating, everybody else thinks is fascinating. And if you don't believe me, talk to some of my friends. Well, people that I know, let me rephrase. maybe students. But the more power that you have, the less concerned you are with other people. And the reason for that, and there's actually neurological changes that you can trace this to, is because you don't have to be mm-hmm. concerned with other people. So you've got people in positions of power, the chancellor and the president. These are, you know, very powerful positions on a college campus. And who is these racist incidents happening to? Are they happening to people that look like the chancellor or the president? Are they happening to people that the chancellor or the president might actually have as personal close friends? No. It's happening to people of color. And so you've got that dynamic working against the president and against the university. And in order to counter that kind of thing, you have to be completely cognizant of the fact that you're going to have to make a special effort to go outside of your comfort zone, to go outside of your mental boundaries, and to try and see the world in a way that doesn't come naturally to you, simply even simply from just being in a position of power.
What's remarkable, though, is okay. So this is Missouri. Okay, so you know, long history of racist events. Fine, but this is 2015. Okay, and open racism really just not okay, pretty much anywhere anymore. Not when it's that open, and it is expected that people at the top are to deal with it, but did not.
And let's also bring one other fact in here, and that is that there was a student who was engaging in a hunger strike.
Yeah.
It wasn't just the football players who said, oh, no, this is unacceptable. I mean, this student had inspired them. And,
right.
And he, you know, that one act, and we've been talking all week during this campaign about the one act, the one thing that people can do, because I can't do anything. This is so big. This is so huge. And then we think, what is it that we can do? That is an inspirational act, and it changed. It's changed things hugely.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But it is kind of interesting, though, that, you know, that while the hunger strike was happening, and I think that the president and the chancellor were like, well, that's a darn shame. But once the football team got involved, and wielded their enormous power,
mm-hmm.
Change happened.
People care about, they may not care about, I'm not going to make any generalizations. I'm just going to say people care about football.
They do.
Well, and if I could add, one of the principal roles of a president of a major university like that is fundraising.
Absolutely.
Football was the pathway to raise that issue, and everybody knew it. Those people being affected. So when the team didn't play, and the university had all of this negative press, that influences donors, mm-hmm. and so it went beyond just the football team. But that became the banner that was public, that was out there, that really helped, I think, drive home the economic reality. And that's the unfortunate part about this is the fact that sometimes people don't operate until it hurts their pocketbook. And in this case, it hurt the university's pocketbook, which goes back to the professor's point, which is, you know, if it's not happening to you, you don't care. Well, the economic reality of the University of Missouri, things were going to happen if the course of dialogue didn't change, and that included changing the president in order to provide an opportunity for the rest of the change that needs to occur. This is a watershed moment, but only if it's captured in the right way by the next leadership that is appointed in that position.
Dr. Gold, you had something you wanted to say?
Yeah. Dr. Ingalls brings up a very good point. When we talk about other isms and stopping the violence, it is important to look at as he brought up, motivations that may not be apparent. So you say, yeah, okay, now it's hurting their pocketbook. But why didn't they stop the racism? Why didn't he make an effort to stop the racism before? Perhaps the calculation was maybe that will make some of our donors feel uncomfortable. All of a sudden, we're going to become a politically correct university. Well, politically correct university is you know, a place where you can't say this and you can't say that, and we've got all these rules and these regulations. That may have mm-hmm. made mm-hmm. some he may have thought that, well, that may make people who support this university uncomfortable. I don't want to go there. I'm just speculating completely.
Sure, absolutely. But I think the whole thing brings up an important point, is that, you know, the football team wielded their power. And, you know, when people are in power or have privilege, they have the opportunity to make things happen. And oftentimes, if they are very comfortable in their position, don't. But it's important. And I'd like to put the appeal out there for those who are in power, those who have privilege, to take opportunities whenever they're possible to do something mm-hmm. and say something. I've had conversations with so many people who just don't say something. If someone says something uncomfortable, then they'll just kind of let it slide by because it's uncomfortable, mm-hmm. you know. But I think it's so critically important to actually say something that it's not okay. This isn't okay. You can't be saying that. You can't be doing that. Right. That's the least.
I agree with you. And it points out how important it is to recognize that every single person in society has some amount of power. And society changes slowly, one person at a time. And if people make the effort, even if it seems like it's not going to change overnight, over a period of years, you know, wonderful things can happen in society. And, of course, there's the famous quote from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., which is, the arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice. And so if you want to talk about society changing over time, you know, obviously people always refer to the civil rights movement. Let's not forget gay marriage. You know, sure. 10-15 years ago, the idea that marriage...
How about 5 years ago?
Yeah, five years ago. Right, right. And how does it start? You know, by people having conversations with each other, by people saying, you know, talking to each other, you know, one-on-one, having conversations, people standing up and saying, this is not right. And it's not necessarily that you have to do something huge or you have to be president of the United States. Because if you look at particularly the gay marriage movement and so many other movements, but yeah, that was obviously clearly a grassroots effort. And then only then, after years and years and years, did it finally percolate up to those in positions of power where they said, oh, yeah, I think gay marriage is a good idea now that everybody else thinks it's a good idea. So we all have some power. Cliff, you made a very good point.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And Christy, were you trying to jump in there?
I was. So I'm going to go back a little bit.
Please.
So, we were talking when you were talking about people saying something, just the simple fact of saying something. And so it kind of goes on the other side of it too. It's when you when you do start speaking out and you do become an advocate for whatever, for many things that are, you know, injustices and biases, you do get that backlash. You will experience, you know, friends and loved ones and community members who, because here, right here, I'm going to tell you straight out, I don't have a problem with saying things. I'm often that person that will say something that's uncomfortable to people. And it's because I want people to think about what's currently happening because it's uncomfortable to me. So if I express like, hey, I really don't feel like what you just said was warranted. Can you tell me why you said that? Rather than, you know, whatever, jumping down somebody's throat. But it's hard sometimes to be that only one person in the room that will say something.
Yep.
And so in real life, 10 years ago, I wouldn't be that one person. But I met a lot of amazing people, and I had my mom tell me, like, Christy, sometimes you just have to be that person that says something. You can come home and call me and vent to me all day long, but sometimes you just need to say something. And so now I can't stop. It's all her fault. Just blame her. but, you know, right now I say things and I post things on Facebook or whatever social media, and I write things, and people get so incensed that at some point it becomes passive aggressive. And so a generalized statement is made is like, oh, all these people just need to calm down. We're all part of the human race. We're all one people. Why is everyone perpetuating hate by talking about hate? Like, it's the worst thing ever. Don't rock the boat. The waters are calm. If you don't just say anything, we're going to be fine. And it's really, really, really annoying. It's one of my, like, one of the one thing that will get me talking is, you know, shoving somebody's voice under the carpet because you don't want them to say something or you don't want them to feel a certain way. Just because you're telling me that I can't have a voice and I can't be upset that these things are happening doesn't mean that I'm not going to feel them, mm-hmm. you know? And I talk to a lot of people and gravitate towards people that have the like minds, and it's so frustrating to have to see and hear and feel that from friends, especially people who you think you have something in common with, and then they turn around and go, why don't you just calm down a little bit? Take that down a few notches. And or, you know, like, it's not even all that, Christy. And it's like, until you can live the experience that I've lived or that these other people have lived, you can't tell somebody what their experiences are and what they have had inside of them. And just because you're experiencing it from a seat of power or privilege or wherever else you are, doesn't mean that you're feeling and seeing and hearing how someone said something to me. So I just wanted to put that out there because, you know, saying something does start the ball rolling, but it can start it rolling in several different ways.
Absolutely. It's much easier and much safer not to say anything.
Yeah. It's like kind of like a pinball.
Yeah. So, you know? I mean, so speaking out, there is absolutely risk to it. There's no doubt about that.
And we may be one people, and we are one people, but we are one people who have a voice, and right. then we need to exercise that voice. And especially when an oppression or some experience is negative is happening, we have the power of voice, mm-hmm. But we also have the power to say things in a way that facilitate the conversation, mm-hmm. that really, because I think the first thing is that people feel chastised and they feel defensive, mm-hmm. and then they stop listening.
Mm-hmm.
And, but we still need to speak the truth, no matter how uncomfortable that truth is.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And on that note, we will continue speaking the truth in our second hour of our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing roundtable discussion right after these quick words from our fine sponsors. All righty. It is about a minute past nine. You've got it on KHUM, Cutton, Eureka, Arcata, and Crescent City. And streaming on the web at KHUM.com. It is our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign. And we are doing our second roundtable discussion dealing with prejudice, privilege, and the violence of otherism. And again, I just want to remind you that if you would like to get in on this conversation, it's not just us. It's certainly open to you as well. 786-KHUM. That's 786-5486. You can also email a question or a comment at studio@KHUM.com. Alrighty, so we're beginning our second hour. It goes by very fast, and it doesn't seem like it possibly could, but It really does.
Well, let's do introductions again in case somebody just said, oh, I'm going to tune in at 9. Mm-hmm. So I'm Sherry Johnson, and I'm Director of Field Education in the Department of Social Work at Humboldt State University and a board member of the Humboldt County Domestic Violence Coordinating Council.
And I'm Gary Eagles, County Superintendent of Schools.
I'm Greg Gold, Professor of Psychology at Humboldt State University.
I'm Christy Johnson. I'm at the Redwood Coast Regional Center as a service coordinator for children.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. All righty. And again, we're dealing with the overarching topic of prejudice, privilege, and the violence of otherism. And one thing I brought up we haven't touched on yet is I guess, building one's career or credibility on otherism, which seems to be a strategy that is currently going on it seems to be going on in the Republican debates. There seems to be, you know, who can otherize a group more than the other to score political points. You know, there was talk about we need to deport all illegal aliens, all of them right now.
You mean people who are do not have papers?
Yes.
Is that what you mean by that term?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just using the terms that are being used.
I know. Can you believe that? That is their language. Yeah. Yeah. And for people who have who are working two jobs because they only make $7.50, and so we're talking about trying to raise minimum wage to $15, which means that you would only maybe have to work one job. But again, there's an assault against people who are advocating for a higher wage because the wages are, you just need to work harder. How can you work harder?
Well, I don't understand the assault on immigration, considering that other than Native Americans in this country, every single person in this country is an immigrant, or at least
is a settler, or in a nice way, a guest,
or a son or daughter here of immigrants,
a little bit.
Yeah. Or forced here, brought here in slave ships.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So it just seems like such a strange thing at this point to be trying to be making political hay and building one's credibility on essentially otherizing, which is amazing to me.
That's so funny because it's not just in the political arena that happens. I mean, I'm going to try to use tact here. Working in education for as long as I have, there are certain people who will, again, use the otherism to gain. How do you say it? Educational currency or,
cultural capital.
Cultural capital. Thank you. That's what I was looking for. And they'll just other it to, with a stick. Like, I am the advocate for everything ever under the sun, ever in life. However, I do not appear to be that. And so I'm going to research it to death. I'm going to talk about it forever. And I'm going to have no idea what I'm talking about because I can never experience it. And that's completely fine. Again, my tact ran away from me, but I don't know how to explain this better than how I'm explaining it. You kind of get a smarmy feeling from people that do that. It's happened rarely at Humboldt State, but I've seen it. It happens more often at conferences. When you're saying, well, what is your research based on? Your sampling group, like what questions did you ask? Because this doesn't make sense to me or 20 other people sitting in this room. So, it's not just politics where that happens. And it's just it's gross. It feels gross. It leaves you with kind of this film in your brain where you're like, I got to go take a bath.
So as a psychologist, I'll deal with this question.
And you talk that way.
Yeah.
When you're doing psychology.
So let's jump in on, I'll jump in on this. So I'll assume that these candidates
have highly paid and highly intelligent advisors. So it's always difficult. In fact, it's impossible to know if these people who are using these tactics are expressing their own personal beliefs or they're using it as a way to try and win the nomination, if we're talking about the Republican Party. So they're trying to appeal to the voters, the people who are going to turn out to vote for them. And so then you have to look – I'm going to try and look at it from that lens. And you have to say, okay, so they're otherizing immigrants. They're otherizing liberals, right? Mm-hmm. They're otherizing basically anybody who
– Who's not them.
Who's not them, and – they say things in terms of they don't care about America. They're going to destroy America. They don't care about the family in the way that we do. And you think, you know, what is that getting to the heart of? Well, there's several things going on, I think, that are important. One of which is that what information do people pay attention to and remember? Mm-hmm. We pay attention to and remember negative information.
Mm-hmm. Our brain, yeah.
Yeah, to a much greater extent than we do positive information.
So it's appealing to fear.
It's appealing to fear, yeah. Mm-hmm. And if you want to think about it, sure. It makes sense. I rode down here on a motorcycle. I'm not looking at all the empty intersections where there's no car about to turn left in front of me and saying, oh, that's cool, there's no car there. No, I'm looking for the car that might turn. So, yeah, that's the way we're wired. Number two, people care about things that are going to live on after them. It's a form of immortality to say to yourself, look, the values that I care about, the things that I care about, the things that I've raised my children and I've talked about with my friends are going to live on after I'm gone. And so a piece of me, a piece of what I care about will be left behind. There's a whole theory that's involved with this. So by saying that, look, these immigrants are coming here, you know what's interesting about these immigrants? They're not coming from Sweden and Denmark and Canada. Nobody's talking about the Swedish and the Danish and the Irish.
And they are
right.
coming.
Right. We're going to send them back to Mexico. Really? Well, there's 11 million undocumented folks here. They're all from Mexico? No. So, you know, we're going to be sending people from Europe back. But they're characterizing it as people from a country where people look different than we do, speak a different language than we do, and values are different. They're Latino values as opposed to mainstream, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant values, and that's threatening to people when they see the culture that they're accustomed to facing the possibility of change. Mm-hmm. They find it personally threatening because they say, "Well, wait a minute. I was raised in this culture. This is what I did. I want to see this culture live." You mean it may not be here after I'm gone? So, in that sense, it threatens them at their very heart. The third thing I wanted to speak about is it's almost like a shell game, right? Look, it's no secret that a lot of money has been flowing from the middle class to the top 0.1%. Mm-hmm. So we have seen the middle class shrinking, life getting harder, and the rich getting richer and richer and richer. So
the trickle down's not working, you're saying?
The trickle down is not working. But if you're part of that 0.1%, I haven't heard anybody, except for maybe Warren Buffett, say, look, you know, we need to do something about this. So how do you maintain the legitimacy of the fact that you are basically robbing the country blind and getting richer and richer and richer, and everybody else, the middle class, is shrinking again and poorer and poorer? You say, well, hey, look over here.
Right.
You know,
right.
Where's the real threat? No, it's not the laws that we're passing to make mortgages harder to get, to make it impossible for middle-class people to declare bankruptcy. No, you need to look over here because the real threat to your economic security are these folks coming from across the border. And if we get rid of those folks, well, then everything's going to be just wonderful and great. And, you know, your jobs will come back. The jobs we've been shipping overseas by the tens of thousands, yeah. You know, changing the law so that you actually get tax breaks for taking a company and offshoring it. Mm-hmm. You know, don't look here. Look over there. Mm-hmm. So I think,
and
I think
be a
that's
part of a group. And be a part of a group. And so even if you're working the job and you're, you know, paying half of your income for whatever, your rent or your mortgage or whatever, mm-hmm. and you're struggling and you have no hope of really having a life of prosperity for yourself and your children, you're still part of a group that's unified against this other.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you know, the demographics of this country are changing. They always will. I mean, this is you know, always has been, always will be a country of immigrants. And the Hispanic and Latino population is growing substantially in this country. It's the largest growing group in this nation, especially here in California. And you know, with that said, you know, the same fear baiting is going on. The same tactics are going on. Even after the last presidential election, when there was a huge meeting saying, what are we doing? We're isolating the Latino and Hispanic community. We've got to not do that. It's happening again. And, I mean, it's like you were talking about these high-paid consultants. I guarantee you none of these high-paid consultants are Latino, because they would say, you're losing the entire population. Mm-hmm. You know, it's... That's, you know, more and more, it's going to be kind of impossible to win an election if you continue to isolate the other, mm-hmm. other than yourself. Because, let's face it, the white male population of privilege is shrinking in this country. And you know, there's going to have to, at some point, be a shift in politics.
Well, we're not going to be shrinking if you keep feeding us donuts.
Thank you.
But in number, to have the minority status, I mean, when you think of, you add up all of the other, that really we are sort of the majority in that sense. And that must be threatening as well. To have that sense of what the ideology in the world that you've grown up changing so dramatically, and that the values in which you feel are maybe absolute values, maybe values that come from the divine authority, challenged. It's, you can see why this becomes such a, you know, emotionally charged kind of conversation.
Absolutely. All right, I'm going to take this opportunity, a quick lull in the conversation, to take a quick break. Let our sponsors say a few words, and we will continue this dialogue in a moment. You've got it on KHUM. The number, 786-KHUM. That's 786-5486. Studio at KHUM.com if you'd like to email a question or comment. And I implore you not to wait to the last second, as most people do. 19 minutes after 9 o'clock, you've got it on KHUM. Our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign continues. We're talking on the topic of privilege, prejudice, and the violence of otherism. And during that break, we had a little bit of a conversation going on here amongst ourselves. That's the time we shared that with you, and it was dealing with the role of education in this.
Right. And there has been, I think, a really ongoing, long-term, you know, well-funded attack on public education, certainly, and on higher education as well, in terms of looking at sort of a more of a business model for higher education, and you know, that's a debate in and of itself. But I think what I want us to really consider is the power of education to change us, the power of education to enlighten and to help us deal with some of these inherited beliefs and biases and prejudices. And it's, I think it's no accident that campuses are now activated in a way that is hopefully going to implement some structural change in the way that students experience their life. But since we have educators here, I think I'll stop now and let them pipe in.
Well, does that tag mean me, maybe? Well, let me start with a a couple of viewpoints about the value of education. And going back to our previous segment where we were talking about redirecting our own anger, or some people, or a lot of people, I guess, redirecting their own anger and frustration with their life and their economic situation, and they want to blame other people. Mm-hmm. And that has spurred a lot of momentum for a lot of the negative conversation that's going on with both parties, to be honest with you. It seems to be a little bit more prevalent in the Republican Party debates because they've had so many, and they've gotten a lot of unfortunate media press. But both parties play off that role. And they generalize and they make statements to try to generate their movement by their base. But it's movement based on emotion, not movement based on education. And one of the reasons why universities are institutions where a lot of social change is initiated is because of the emphasis on education and understanding more, and being willing to listen to other viewpoints and understanding those viewpoints so that you can develop a more well-balanced perspective internally and therefore behave differently because of it. Political parties today, unfortunately, are not interested in having a well-educated populace because they would rather drive support for their particular position based on emotion. But if you're thinking emotionally, or acting emotionally, I should say, you're not thinking intellectually. That part of the brain is diminished in terms of its activity. So if you sit back, though, and take the opportunity not to go to just the same talk shows, political talk shows that you always go to, just to listen to more of the same that you think you believe in, but actually take the opportunity to hear the other side, and then go beneath that, turn off the talk shows, and actually study the issues, actually look at each individual issue that is there on the table that needs to be debated, and gather for your own self that education, that understanding. It does change the posture. That's one aspect of education. The other thing about bringing it a little closer to home is that we are concerned in the K-12 system here in Humboldt County of how many young children are exposed in this community to what has been labeled to be toxic stress, and how that living under those conditions as a young child actually reframes and changes the pattern of thought process. There's some emerging research that's come out in just the last few years which talks about the neurology, the neurobiology of how people do end up modifying their natural response or reaction to the world around them if they come from a situation in which they've constantly lived with this level of toxic stress. Mm-hmm. And to which you know, just very briefly, if you live in a situation where your flight or fight tendencies as a human being are constantly elevated, the chemical that produces that flight or fight reaction internally in humans actually is detrimental to the body's physiology. Mm-hmm. I would encourage the listeners to take the opportunity to go to a YouTube presentation by Nadine Burke Harris, who brings home, she's a medical practitioner in the San Francisco Bay Area, who's been involved in a lot of this research. It's a fascinating conversation over about a 15, 16-minute period in which she talks about the long-range negative physiological consequences of having grown up as a child with toxic stress, and then historically how lifespan is affected, mm-hmm. health is affected, heart, lung disease, the correlation with a number of things of bad physiological health with some of the mm-hmm. mental issues that we have. But also this issue of toxic stress and the research about it also talks about how that can be counteracted when people are brought into situations where there is strong nurturing support, because it not only gives them the opportunity to calm down, to be able to reframe, to be able to learn to respond to their environment differently, not look at the whole world as out to get them, but to actually be able to think differently and therefore respond differently, and perform better, improving their emotional well-being, their social interactions, and ultimately the physiology. Fascinating work, and it's a great place to start.
So one thing that you talked about at the very beginning was dealing with the education being accessible to everyone, and that it's being a great equalizer with regard to whatever political dialogue you're talking about. If you have an education, if you understand what the facts are, you can engage in the debate from a intellectual standpoint rather than an emotional standpoint. And one thing that the push to privatize more and more public education, and with all the public or with all the private college for profit colleges, is that it tends to make education less accessible to those at the bottom, and it creates. I feel it's we're in danger of creating a class society if we if we go down this road, and there seems to be a real push for it for privatizing public education, which seems, kind of amazing. That's one of the things that we have in this country that's such a plus, is our public education system, is that everyone has a right to it. And it's getting, to be less and less, especially in the upper education. We've got, community colleges used to be free. They're no longer free. Right. Even like places like Humboldt State, it still costs a certain amount of money to go there. You have to have...
It costs a huge amount of money. And one thing I do want to just respectfully disagree with you, Dr. Eagles, but there is one party that is advocating for access to higher education in that be free, that community college, and that's Bernie Sanders, for sure. Whoops.
He has
proposed that for sure, and I think Hillary may be supporting that as well. So I think that's an important distinction to make.
Okay, I'll go. So I want to look at this through a larger lens.
Yes.
And the lens that I want to look at it through is from a theory from a man named Jim Sedanius, and he calls it social dominance orientation theory. Basically. Talk for days about that. The point he makes is that societies are hierarchical in nature. They always have been. Once you get beyond the hunter-gatherer stage, how do you maintain the hierarchy? Because in every hierarchical society, there's a group at the top that has the disproportionate amount of resources. They have the power. They have the money. Whatever society considers to be good, they always have a disproportionate amount of resources. We see it in this country now to an extent that we've never seen it before. You can look all over the world and you see that. How do you maintain that structure? How do you maintain a very small percentage of people? What is it, 1%? They call it the 1% here. And how do you keep those 99% from taking it back from you? And the way you do it is through what Jim calls legitimizing myths. You spread myths about the legitimacy of this small group of people having most of the wealth and the large group of people not having any of the wealth. And one of the legitimizing myths that we see in this country is the Protestant work ethic. If you just work hard enough, you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps and you can be a billionaire just like me.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right? And what is antithetical to that? What exposes these legitimizing, that's just one, there's a lot of them.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
What exposes these legitimizing myths for the man behind the curtain, if I can use a Wizard of Oz analogy? Education and a free press. Mm-hmm. Those are the two things that terrify hierarchies. Because if you have a proper education system where the truth from science is being taught, and I'm talking not just the hard sciences, but the social sciences, true, political science, social science, right? The truth about history is being taught in an honest, that threatens the hierarchy in society. And what's the other thing that threatens the hierarchy in society? A free and open press. And what have we seen an assault on, basically since Ronald Reagan, a assault on the free press,
with an press, education. Yes, and an assault on education, starting with the K through 12, and now continuing now a strong assault on a higher education. And there's a lot of ways to go about it. You can delegitimize it, which you hear constantly. They're lying. They're not telling you the truth. You know, they're just in it for the money. Things like with climate change.
Yeah, we're the elite.
Right. We're the elite. Right. Right. And you see it in another manner by making it inaccessible in terms of cost.
Well, if you step back and take a look at every, you know, every tyrannical society has always done that. They've always, you know, made sure there was no free press, made sure that they limited education. I mean, you take a look at, I mean, look at Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge. You know, that was like, that was a very dramatic and instantaneous way of dealing with it. But I mean, it's like that's, you know, it's that is true. That
Great
is how you
forward in China. It's true all over the world. And what was our founding fathers very, very, what's the First Amendment? You know, freedom of speech, freedom of the press.
Right. I mean, first.
The first, right? They knew that if you're going to have a strong democracy and not an oligarchy and not a plutocracy and not a new model of feudalism, which is practically what we have now, you need an educated population.
Right. And that's why, you know, I agree with the idea of I have no problem with there being private colleges and, you know, private universities and all that. I think that's fine. They're wonderful, but there needs to be a way for people who have nothing to be able to get the highest education that anyone can get,
and then not enter into indentured servitude.
Right.
I mean, not owe such huge sums of money that you would never be able to pay it back.
Exactly.
And let's remind everybody that was the truth. That was the system that was set up in California. JCs were free.
They were free.
That's right.
Completely free.
CSUs were free. UCs were free. And then who became governor? The Holy One, blessed be he.
the one who said, you've seen one redwood, you've seen them all.
Yes.
I'm going to go back to Dr. Eagle's conversation about children being able to learn and how there's been a slow but steady transformation of the environment to be more trauma-informed in terms of an educational perspective and approach, because so many students are under stress. So many students are traumatized by parents with mental health, living with mental health issues or substance issues, or, you know, having to work two or three jobs, or not being able to find a job, not having a home, living without a home. How can you, you know, as somebody once said, standing in front of the Board of Supervisors pleading for them not to close the winter shelter, how can I think about getting a job when I can't stop thinking about where I'm going to get something to eat? So if we are now aware of this, if now we can really start looking at how do we make our K through 12 especially more open, more welcoming, more sensitive to the true reality of what children are experiencing, I can only hope that is going to substantially change the outcome, the learning outcomes for those children.
Oh, I agree, Sherry. We're doing what we can to spread the conversation and increase the understanding, as you talk about, to become more trauma-informed. Because what happens is that it does change the expectations within the school cultures and how educators respond, how educators choose words to communicate to children and to families, and also to help provide the nurturing kind of environments that need to be in existence to counteract. To give you a similar situation, for example, if you have a child who's truant, constantly absent, the disciplinary approach to that probably wouldn't be to suspend them from school when they finally did show up, right?
Right.
I mean, so what we're talking about is aligning our actions and reactions as an educational system in the context of dealing with where the child is coming from, not the system. You know, and we're finally coming to the realization that you just can't suspend yourself out of and change behavior can't expel these kids, because what do kids do when they're not part of the system? They need to be brought closer to the system, given alternatives, given additional supports and different types of supports. And again, the research is informing us as to how we can go about doing that. And so working with both preschool 0 to 5, the first five here in Humboldt County, as well as some funding from the Department of Health and Human Services, plus additional resources that my office is contributing, we're now engaging in those conversations with more than a dozen of our 31 school districts. We have more than 120 individuals that are engaged in ongoing sustained education as part of the part of that dialogue going on right now this year. And it's our intent to take that conversation even further. And building on those trauma-informed practices and cultures are pursuits of restorative justice dimensions in terms of how to deal with disciplinary situations. And we are becoming more enlightened. And I think as we do that, we're going to be able to counteract some of the things that we're actually seeing in our community. I am very hopeful about the direction in which we're now moving.
And it's shifting the question from, instead of what's wrong with you, is what happened to you. Mm-hmm. And it's a simple kind of a shift, but it changes everything.
And on that note, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll return to this conversation in just a few moments. Let our sponsors say a few words. It's our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign, our 20th here on KHUM, and we're dealing with prejudice and privilege and the violence of otherism and the broad spectrum that that encompasses. And you are invited to be part of the conversation at 786-KHUM, at 786-5486. If you would like to just email a question or a thought, studio at KHUM.com. All right, we're 19 minutes away from 10 o'clock, so we're getting very close to wrapping up this campaign. I asked Dr. Gold. Not the campaign.
The one more week after this.
Yes, we have a whole other week. I misspoke. We're almost done wrapping up this discussion here. So I was talking with Dr. Gold. I said, is there anything that we haven't touched on? I mean, you teach a course on the psychology of prejudice. Is there anything we haven't touched on that you think would be important? And you basically mentioned the normality of prejudice.
That's right. And I think it's really important when we think about this topic, and this was said during the break, is not to otherize the other, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about prejudice, when you talk about discrimination, we like to jump to the conclusion that people who are engaging in practices and behavior that we consider prejudice or discrimination are somehow evil people or have nefarious motives or are somehow different than quote unquote us. And it's important to keep in mind that they're not. And I think that's one of the solutions to the problem of prejudice and discrimination, is to try and understand what the motives are, what needs this behavior is serving, and why we see this kind of behavior. Because it's simply, according to the research, not true that these acts that we find abhorrent are perpetrated by people who might have something quote unquote wrong with them. Mm-hmm. People are people, and let me drive this message home about the normality of prejudice. It's the if you look around the world and you look at history, either you have to say, especially when you go back in history, you have to say, look at the things that everyday people considered good and normal. For example, slavery in this country, right? Were all those people who owned slaves and who didn't speak out against it, was there something? No, there was not something wrong with
it. It was the normal.
It was the normal. And the genocide of the Native American people, right? The people who were engaged in that genocide and the people who supported, was there something wrong with those people? You know, were they evil?
Of course, it should be said that in, you know, all those cases, there were people who spoke out against.
There were people who spoke out against.
And the behavior is evil.
Yes.
The actions taken are unforgivable.
The
really.
Actions taken are unforgivable, but people engage in unforgivable actions.
Right.
Everyday people engage in unforgivable actions. So what's going on with folks? And if you're going to reach people, if you're going to create a more inclusive society, I don't think you can come at it from the psychology or from the viewpoint as you're wrong, you're evil, and I'm good. There's something wrong with you, but there's not something wrong with me. And the way I think people can move a society forward is to try and understand the basic humanity at the core of what people are expressing. So you say, okay, well, people are afraid of undocumented immigrants, right? Are those evil people? No. Why are they afraid? Where is this fear coming from? Where are these strong emotions of dislike or even hatred in some folks coming from? And, you know, what is the basic humanity behind that? And then if you can have those kinds of conversations, if you can have those kinds of dialogues, I think then you create a greater, more inclusive society, and you can start to see progress.
And of course, there is the psychology of the fact that, you know, it only takes a few people to influence, you know, a very large amount of people, because just most people will go along with. Even if it goes against their grain. I mean, there was an amazing study, I'm sure you're well aware of it, since you teach in the psychology department. This took place, I believe, in the 70s. It was called, they made a movie about it called The 10th Level, where they had it was a college experiment, which was a fake college experiment. What they did is they hooked up these electrodes to someone, and you were told by a professor to push, you know, the button, you know, 1 through 10, and it would give a painful jolt to the person, and it didn't. But the people who were pushing the buttons did not know that, and they were told to push the 10th button, the 10th level, which was supposed to be an excruciating jolt of pain. And almost everyone did it, even though they protested and they said, "No, I can't do that. Mm-hmm. You signed up for this; you have to do it."
Yeah, people even cried about it and still pushed the button.
They still pushed
Milgram.
It.
Experiment.
Yeah.
The Stanley Milgram experiment. And then there's also the bystander effect. There's all kinds of things that play into Stanley Milgram experiment. When people don't feel responsible for something, you know, then they'll go along with authority, right? And the bystander, you know, effect is the idea that we think someone else will take care of the problem, right? Then there's the other thing is we call pluralistic ignorance, which is if nobody's saying anything and one person is speaking loudly, but nobody says anything. Nobody says anything because nobody else is saying anything. So they think, well, that person is speaking loudly. Nobody's saying anything. Everybody must think the same way that person thinks. And everybody's thinking the same way. Everybody must be thinking the same way that person. I'm not going to say anything because I'm going to be the only one. Everybody's thinking those same things. I call it pluralistic ignorance. So
Christy, I know earlier in our conversation you said that you didn't always speak out, and now you do. What changed for you?
I think it was recognizing that my voice has a place, or even recognizing that I have a voice, because I didn't really speak a whole lot in real life, in reality. I had a twin brother who was much more talkative than I was. So there's a real reason for that. And then when I came here myself without him, it was my responsibility to take on that kind of thing. But also, I started working in service for others because I realized that some people don't have voices and they don't know where to find them or where to start. And so, you know, there's this whole thing, if no one says anything, then it's just going to be there. It's just going to happen. And then that bystander thing happens where it's like someone else is going to take care of it, or even the cognitive dissonance where it's like, one person by themselves probably wouldn't engage in this behavior, but if 20 people get together and they start doing it, then obviously us together doing it is fine, but I would never do it outside. I actually did some research on that as an undergraduate student about slavery and how it's possible, and I talked about cognitive dissonance and hugely. But what I wanted to do is also go back a little bit and talk about when Cliff was saying it's 2015, how could, you know, this still be happening? And,
right.
You know, that's that whole post-racial era thing. And I want to throw it out there. I mean, it's not that things have changed so drastically. It's 2015. How could this be happening? It's that it's still happening and it continues to happen, regardless of who's in where, what power, seat of power, and who's doing what. It's out there in the open. In California, we experience it differently, but in other parts of the country, it's still blatant in your face. It happens every day, and it's not until someone uses their voice or their actions, like the University of Missouri, where it comes to light and everyone's like, oh, holy crap, that still happens. How is that possible? And just because we're not seeing it doesn't mean it isn't happening all the time.
Yeah, indeed. That's why we are talking about this.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Because you know, that's I had several conversations with people saying, well, you know, racism is there's no
gone.
Racism anywhere. It's gone. And
it's
like, are you crazy?
It's extinct.
I said, well, that's because, you know, yes, being someone of privilege, you may not notice that it is still alive and well and kicking,
mm-hmm.
and you know, and it may have taken on other forms. It's become more socially acceptable in different formats, but it still shows quite a bit.
Yep.
And I think, and it's challenging to talk about intersectionality, you know, to talk about, you know, I mean, it's kind of easier to take just like sort of one subject and really drill down in that and deconstruct that. But what we've tried to do is really sort of make some relationships and some connections and see some patterns and to realize that there is a connection between all of this objectification that mm-hmm. takes place when you dehumanize and make people objects, not me, them, you know, us, not them, or them, not us. That we have this polarity and these dichotomies, and then we are separated.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, where we can come together and where we can be allies, where we can support each other, that's what we're going to be doing next week. Is that's what we want to talk about. And I, you know, because I make up these weird kind of titles like In Our Bodies, Celebrating Allies. But I think that we can't be an ally to somebody else if in our body we're at war with ourselves.
Exactly.
And I think that the whole being embodied and in our bodies and body image and you know, being judged for how you look, it crosses so many dimensions. So we want to talk about how to be allies to our own bodies. And we want to talk about how to be allies to others, not just other human beings either, but to animals and the earth.
Can I say
Please.
One more thing?
Yes, yes.
Before you go into your last part, but I also want to say that for people who are, you know, large, huge advocates in their communities for, you know, a plethora of groups of people, it's also important to remember that when you do work with people, you're not working for them, you're not doing this for them, you're doing it with them, because then you forget to ask, is this something you would like me to help you with, instead of taking it on and doing it yourself and assuming everybody wants this to happen. It's important to remember that you're working with a group of people and not for them.
Absolutely. So before we have our closing thoughts, because we're just about at that point, let's talk about what we've got coming up next week. So you did touch on that, Sherry, that we're going to be looking at celebrating allies. And Professor Maxwell Schnur is going to be my first guest. And we've talked with him before. What's that?
Yay, Max.
He's a great guy.
Yeah.
He's a terrific guy, and we'll be looking at microaggressions and various other things.
And he
can talk about the, you know, who is an ally and what is the role of ally and
absolutely
how to be a good ally.
Absolutely. And on the 18th, I'm going to put it out there because I think we're going to get it. I still have not gotten a confirmation yet, but I'm trying to get.
I'm like, what is the backup plan?
I don't have one yet. I'm putting my faith in this is going to come through. We're in contact with the Southern Poverty Law Center and hoping to, because they've been champions in civil rights for such a long time. And we're looking to get a spokesperson from them on the 18th and 19th. We're going to be talking with Dr. Renee Bird, and that's going to be a pre-recorded interview, just as the one with Dr. Lauren Cannon was.
Which was fantastic.
Which was fantastic. And then on Friday the 20th, a week from today, it's our healing breakfast. This is going to be taking place at the Women's Club, which is at 1531 J Street in Eureka.
In Eureka, down from Eureka High School.
That is right. And it's a terrific location, and we're going to have a wonderful panel of panelists to speak. Plus, we also have got music from the True Gospel Singers, delicious yummies from Ramon's Bakery. We have got signature coffee, flowers, decorating the room from Sun Valley Floral
and
Farm.
Quilts.
Uh-huh.
And absolutely. Quilt making.
And what time is that?
That's 8
a.m. It's the same time as this show, so it'll be broadcast live, but only from the Eureka studio.
Yes, from the Eureka Women's Club. And, of course, resource tables all around the room from all kinds of various great organizations that are on the front lines dealing with this kind of stuff every day. So we really appreciate them all taking the time. It's always a wonderful thing. But since we are pretty much out of time, I will give everyone a few seconds to some final thoughts on our
right.
conversation.
We started with you, Christy. We'll end with you. Just some final words.
Oh, I'm sorry. I gave my final words at the other part, but final words. Otherism. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. You know, again, I walked in this room and I said, holy crap. Excuse my language. I don't even know if I can say that.
You can.
But okay. Oh, my goodness. I'm in this room over here with the professor and then the superintendent of education over here. But then I realized I have a voice, too. So, again, it's always that thing that plays in your head, you know, regardless of what things you've overcome. And so I'm saying that to say that when you do work with people and they do fall into those habits of saying things or doing things or acting on things that have been detrimental to themselves and others, you have to give them a little bit of grace and say, did you really mean to say that? Or did you really mean to do that? You know, kind of question it a little bit. And sometimes people go, oh, I wasn't even listening. And, you know, people, you know, that effort, that Freudian slip thing, and they go, oh, I'm sorry, it was a Freudian slip. And it's like, well, yeah, but remember we talked about that. So, you know, just kind of, you don't always need to have the kid gloves on when you work with people, but I mean, it's important that you remember that education is an ongoing thing with people, and it takes a long time to change those neural pathways that have already been created, because they are physical constructs in your brain that you are trying to change.
All right. And, Greg, you got 30 seconds to wrap up.
Sure. I want to obviously thank Cliff and Kay Hum and the whole organization and Sherry and everybody here. But if I was going to leave people with one thought, I would say, remember, society can get better. Society does get better if you work for it. And it's a legitimizing myth to say that you as an individual can't do anything, that this is the way things are, and this is the way things always will be. The only people that serves are the people at the top of the hierarchy who don't want things to change. And society can change, and it does change. It may change slowly, but if we work for it, things get better.
Thank you.
Well, I too would like to extend my appreciation to Sherry and Cliff and my guest panelists that joined me today. It was a privilege to be with them. When I was a fourth grade teacher, I had two rules in the classroom. Respect yourself, respect others. I think those are two good rules to abide by, regardless of our age or grade level. So I'll just leave that for the folks to think about.
Excellent.
Well, I want to thank you, Christy, and thank you, Dr. Gold and Dr. Eagle, so much for sharing this time with us and being willing to come and, you know, with kind of an open mind to a topic that is pretty open-ended. I really, truly appreciate all of the conversation and your courage for being able to speak your thoughts and for the audience to listen to us, you know, expound on some pretty important topics.
All righty. And I guess my final thought is I am I'm an eternal optimist. I do believe that we can grow as a species, and I think these kinds of dialogues help. I think putting things out on the open instead of sweeping them under the rug helps us grow, and hopefully we can each make a difference just to, you know, in our own lives and maybe just around us as well. If you know, just do things a little differently. If there's something that that you think needs to be changed, just do it, because we can. We're human beings. We are not always driven by instinct. We have choice. So, and anyway, we'll leave it at that. I will take our final break here, and we'll hand the reins over to Bailey Brown up next.